Chapter 14. Artistic Elements. Dysprosium, praseodymium, strontium, ruthenium, radium, lithium. As science grew more sophisticated throughout its history, it grew correspondingly expensive, and money, big money, began to dictate if, when, and how science got done. Already by 1956, the German-English novelist Sibylle Bedford could write that many generations had passed since the laws of the universe were something a man might deal with pleasantly in a workshop set up behind the stables. Of course, very few people, mostly landed gentlemen, could have afforded a little workshop in which to do their science during the eras Bedford was pining for, the 18th and 19th centuries. To be sure, it's no coincidence that people from the upper classes were usually the ones doing things like discovering new elements. No one else had the leisure to sit around and argue about what some obscure rocks were made of. This mark of aristocracy lingers on the periodic table, an influence you can read without an iota of knowledge about chemistry. Gentlemen from Europe received educations heavy in the classics and many element names. Cerium, thorium, promethium point to ancient myths. The really funny-looking names, too, such as praseodymium, molybdenum, and dysprosium, are amalgams of Latin and Greek. Dysprosium means little hidden one, since it's tricky to separate from its brother elements. Praseodymium means green twin, for similar reasons. Its other half is neodymium, new twin. The names of noble gases mostly mean stranger or inactive. Even proud French gentlemen, as late as the 1880s, chose not France and Paris when enshrining new elements, but the philologically moribund Gallia, gallium, and lutetia, lutetium, respectively, as if sucking up to Julius Caesar. All this seems odd today. Scientists receiving more training in antique languages than, well, in science. But for centuries, science was less a profession than a hobby for amateurs like philately. Science wasn't yet mathematized, the barriers for entry were low, and a nobleman with the clout of, say, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe could bully his way into scientific discussions, qualified or not. Today, Goethe is remembered as a writer whose range and emotive power many critics rank second only to Shakespeare's. And beyond his writing, he took an active role in government and in policy debates in nearly every field. Many people still rank him as the greatest, most accomplished German ever to live. But I have to admit that my first impression of Goethe was that he was a bit of a fraud. One summer in college, I worked for a physics professor who, though a wonderful storyteller, was forever running out of really basic supplies like electronic cables, which meant I had to visit the departmental supply room in the basement to beg. The dungeon master there was a German-speaking man. In keeping with his Quasimodo-like job, he was often unshaven and had shoulder-length, tendrilled hair, and his big arms and chest would have seemed hulking had he stood taller than 5'6". I trembled every time I knocked on his door, never knowing what to sputter back when he narrowed his eyes and said, more a scoff than a question, "He does not have any coaxial cable?" My relationship with him improved the next semester when I took a required course he co-taught. It was a lab which meant tedious hours building and wiring things, and during the dead time he and I talked literature once or twice. One day he mentioned Goethe, whom I didn't know. "He's the Shakespeare of Germany," he explained. "All the stuck-up German assholes. All the time they quote him. It's disgusting. Then they say, 'What, you don't know Goethe?'" He had read Goethe in the original German and found him mediocre. I was still young enough to be impressed by any strong convictions, and the denunciation made me suspicious of Goethe as a great thinker. Years later, after reading more widely, I came to appreciate Goethe's literary talent. But I had to admit my lab director had a point about Goethe's mediocrity in some areas. Though an epical, world-changing author, Goethe couldn't hold back from making pronouncements in philosophy and science, too. He did so with all the enthusiasm of a dilettante and about as much competence. In the late 1700s, Goethe devised a theory of how colors work, to refute Isaac Newton's theory. Except Goethe's relied as much on poetry as science, including his whimsical thesis that colors are the deeds of light, deeds, and suffering. Not to huff like a positivist, but that statement has absolutely no meaning. He also laded his novel Elective Affinities with the spurious idea that marriages work like chemical reactions. That is, if you throw couple AB in contact with couple CD, they all might naturally commit chemical adultery and form new pairs. AB plus CD yields AD plus BC. And this wasn't just implied or a metaphor. Characters actually discuss this algebraic rearrangement of their lives. Whatever the novel's other strengths, especially its depiction of passion, Goethe would have been better off cutting out the science. Even Goethe's masterwork, Faust, contains hoary speculation on alchemy and, worse, alchemy is at least cool, a bootless Socratic dialogue between Neptunists and Plutonists on how rocks form. Author's note, Plutonists were sometimes called Vulcanists, too, after the fire god Vulcan. This moniker emphasized the role of volcanoes in the formation of rocks. Neptunists, like Goethe, thought rocks precipitated from minerals in the ocean, the realm of the god Neptune. They were wrong. Plutonists, who were named after the underworld god Pluto and whose argument was taken up in a rather unsubtle dig by Satan himself in Faust, argued correctly that volcanoes and heat deep within the earth form most rocks. As usual, Goethe picked the losing side because it pleased him aesthetically. Faust remains as powerful a tale of scientific hubris as Frankenstein, but Goethe would have been crushed after his death in 1832 to learn that its science and philosophy would soon disintegrate and that people now read his work strictly for its literary value. Nevertheless, Goethe did make one lasting contribution to science generally and the periodic table specifically, through patronage. In 1809, as a minister of the state, Goethe had the responsibility to pick a scientist for an open chair in chemistry at the University of Jena. After hearing recommendations from friends, Goethe had the foresight to select another Johann Wolfgang, J.W. Döbereiner. He was a provincial man with no chemistry degree and a poor resume, having given chemistry a shot only after failing in the drug, textile, agricultural, and brewing industries. Döbereiner's work in industry, however, taught him practical skills that a gentleman like Goethe never learned, but much admired during an age of great industrial leaps. Goethe soon developed a strong interest in the young man, and they spent many happy hours discussing hot chemistry topics of the day, such as why red cabbage tarnishes silver spoons and what the ingredients in Madame de Pompadour's toothpaste were. But the friendship couldn't quite erase vast differences in background and education. Goethe, naturally, had received a broadly classical education, and even today he is often hailed, with a touch of hyperbole, as the last man who knew everything, which was still possible back when art, science, and philosophy overlapped a great deal. It's fitting, then, that Döbereiner's greatest contribution to science was inspired by one of the rare elements, strontium, whose name is neither Hellenic nor based on something in Ovid. Strontium was the first flicker that something like the periodic table existed. A doctor discovered it in a hospital lab in London's Red Light District in 1790, not far from Shakespeare's Old Globe Theatre. He named it after the origin of the minerals he was studying, strontian, a mining village in Scotland, and Döbereiner picked up his work 20 years later. Döbereiner's research focused, notice the practicality, on finding precise ways to weigh elements, and strontium was new and rare, a challenge. With Goethe's encouragement, he set out to study its characteristics. As he refined his figures on strontium, though, he noticed something queer. its weight fell exactly between the weights of calcium and barium. Moreover, when he looked into the chemistry of strontium, it behaved like barium and calcium in chemical reactions. Strontium was somehow a blend of two elements, one lighter and one heavier. Intrigued, Dobereiner began to precisely weigh more elements, scouting around for other triads. Up popped chlorine, bromine, and iodine, sulfur, selenium, and tellurium, and more. In each case, the weight of the middle element fell halfway between its chemical cousins. Convinced this was not a coincidence, Dobereiner began to group these elements into what today we'd recognize as columns of the periodic table. Indeed, the chemists who erected the first periodic tables 50 years later started with Dobereiner's pillars. Author's note: Dobereiner called his groupings of elements not triads, but affinities, part of his larger theory of chemical affinities, a term that gave Goethe, who frequently attended Dobereiner's lectures at Jena, the inspiration for the title Elective Affinities. Now, the reason 50 years passed between Dobereiner and Dmitri Mendeleev without a periodic table was that the triad work got out of hand. Instead of using strontium and its neighbors to search for a universal way to organize matter, chemists, influenced by Christianity, alchemy, and the Pythagorean belief that numbers somehow embody true metaphysical reality, began seeing trinities everywhere and delving into triadic numerology. They calculated trilogies for the sake of calculating trilogies and elevated every three-in-one relationship, no matter how tenuous, into something sacred. Nevertheless, thanks to Dobereiner, strontium was the first element correctly placed in a larger universal scheme of elements. And Dobereiner never would have figured all this out without first the faith and then the support of Goethe. Then again, Dobereiner did make his patron look like even more of a genius for supporting him all along when, in 1823, he invented the first portable lighter. This lighter relied on the curious ability of platinum to absorb and store massive amounts of burnable hydrogen gas. In an era when all cooking and heating still required fire, it proved an unfathomable economic boon. The lighter, called Dobereiner's lamp, actually made Dobereiner almost as famous worldwide as Goethe. So even if Goethe made a poor show of things in his own scientific work, his writing helped spread the idea that science was noble, and his patronage nudged chemists toward the periodic table. He deserves at least an honorary position in the history of science, which, in the end, might have satisfied him. To quote no less a personage than Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, apologies to my old lab director, "The history of science is science itself." Goethe valued the intellectual beauty of science, and people who value beauty in science tend to revel in the symmetries of the periodic table and its Bach-like repetitions with variation. Yet not all the table's beauty is abstract. The table inspires art in all guises. Gold and silver and platinum are themselves lovely, and other elements such as cadmium and bismuth bloom into bright, colorful pigments in minerals or oil paints. Elements play a strong role in design, too, in the making of beautiful everyday objects. New alloys of elements often provide some subtle edge in strength or flexibility that transforms a design from functional to phenomenal. And with an infusion of the right element, something as humble as a fountain pen can achieve a design that, if it's not too embarrassing to say it, and for some pen aficionados it's not, inches close to majesty. Author's note: another majestic design inspired by elements is the wooden periodic table, a coffee table built by Theodore Gray. The table has more than 100 slots on top, in which Gray has stored samples of every extant element, including many exclusively man-made ones. Of course, he has only minute quantities of some. His samples of francium and astatine, the two rarest natural elements, are actually hunks of uranium. Gray's argument is that somewhere buried deep inside those hunks are at least a few atoms of each one, which is true and honestly about as good as anyone has ever done. Besides, since most of the elements on the table are gray metals, it's hard to tell them apart anyway. In the late 1920s, the legendary Hungarian and later American designer Laszlo Moholy Nagy drew an academic distinction between forced obsolescence and artificial obsolescence. Forced obsolescence is the normal course of things for technologies, the roughage of history books. Plows gave way to reapers, muskets to Gatling guns, wooden boat hulls to steel. In contrast, artificial obsolescence did and increasingly would dominate the 20th century, Moholy Nagy argued. People were abandoning consumer goods not because the goods were superannuated, but because the Joneses had some newer, fancier design. Moholy Nagy, an artist and something of a philosopher of design, couched artificial obsolescence as materialistic, infantile, and a moral disintegration. And as hard as it is to believe, the humble pen once seemed an example of people's gluttonous need for something, anything, advanced, and all too now. The career of the pen as Frodo's ring began in 1923 with one man. At 28, Kenneth Parker convinced the directors of the family business to concentrate the firm's money into a new design, his luxury duofold pen. He smartly waited until Mr. Parker, his dad, the big boss, had left for a long sea voyage around Africa and Asia and couldn't veto him. 10 years later, in the worst days of the Great Depression, Parker gambled again by introducing another high-end model, the Vacumatic. And just a few years after that, Parker, by then boss himself, was itching for another new design. He had read and absorbed Moholy Nagy's theories of design, but instead of letting the moral reproach of artificial obsolescence hem him in, Parker saw it in true American fashion. A chance to make a lot of money. If people had something better to buy, they would, even if they didn't need it. To this end, in 1941, he introduced what's widely considered the greatest pen in history, the Parker 51, named after the number of years the Parker Pen Company had been operating when this wonderful and utterly superfluous model hit the stores. It was elegance herself. The pen's caps were gold or chrome-plated, with a gold-feathered arrow for the pen's clasp. The body was as plump and tempting to pick up as a cigarillo and came in dandy colors such as blue cedar, Nassau green, cocoa, plum, and rage red. The pen's head, colored India black, looked like a shy turtle's head, which tapered to a handsome calligraphic-style mouth. And from that mouth extended a tiny gold nib, like a rolled-up tongue, to dispense ink. Inside that sleek frame, the pen ran on a newly patented plastic called Lucite, and a newly patented cylindrical system for delivering a newly patented ink. Ink that, for the first time in penmanship history, dried not by evaporation while sitting on the paper, but by penetrating into the paper's fibers, drying via absorption in an instant. Even the way the cap snapped onto the pen body received two patents. Parker's engineers were scribal geniuses. The only mole on this beauty was the tip of the gold nib, the part that actually touched the paper. Gold, a soft metal, deforms under the rigorous friction of writing. Parker originally capped the nib with a ring of osmeridium, an alloy of iridium and osmium. The two metals were suitably tough, but scarce, expensive, and a headache to import. A sudden shortage or price hike might doom the design. So Parker hired a metallurgist away from Yale University to find a replacement. Within a year, the company filed for another patent for a ruthenium tip, an element little better than scrap until then. But it was a tip, finally, worthy of the rest of the design, and ruthenium began capping every Parker 51 in 1944. Author's note. The famed tip on the Parker 51 was actually 96% ruthenium and 4% iridium. The company advertised the nibs as being made of super durable platinum, presumably to mislead competitors into thinking that expensive platinum was the key. Now, honestly, despite its superior engineering, the Parker 51 was probably about equal to most pens in its basic job, delivering ink onto paper. But as design prophet Moholy Nagy could have predicted, fashion trumped need. With its new tip, the company convinced consumers, through advertising, that human writing instruments had reached their apotheosis, and people began throwing away earlier Parker models to grab this one. The 51, the world's most wanted pen, became a status symbol, the only thing the classiest bankers, brokers, and politicians would sign checks, bar tabs, and golf scorecards with. Even Generals Dwight D. Eisenhower and Douglas MacArthur used 51s to sign the treaties that ended World War II in Europe and the Pacific in 1945. With such publicity and with the optimism that washed over the world at the end of the war, sales jumped from 440,000 units in 1944 to 2.1 million in 1947. An amazing feat, considering that the 51 cost at least $12.50 at the time and ran up to $50, $100 to $400 today, and that the refillable ink cartridge and durable ruthenium tip meant that no one had to replace the pen. Even Moholy Nagy, though thoroughly distressed at how smoothly his theories had translated into marketing, had to whistle at the 51. Its balance in the hand, its look, its creamy delivery of ink. Moholy Nagy swooned and once cited it as the perfect design. He even took a job consulting for Parker starting in 1944. After that, rumors persisted for decades that Moholy Nagy had designed the 51 himself. Parker continued to sell various models of the 51 through 1972, and though twice as expensive as its next cheapest competitor, it had outsold every pen ever made up to that point, reaping $400 million in sales, a few billion dollars today. Of course, not long after the Parker 51 disappeared, the market for high-end pens began to shrivel. The reason is pretty obvious. While the 51 had thrived on making other pens seem inferior, pens were gradually being forced into obsolescence by technologies like the typewriter. But there's an ironic story to unbury in that takeover, which starts with Mark Twain and wends its way back to the periodic table. After seeing a demonstration of a typewriter in 1874, and despite a worldwide economic depression, Twain ran right out and bought one for the outrageous price of $125, $2,400 today. Within a week, he was writing letters on it, in all capitals, it had no lowercase, about how he looked forward to giving it away. "It is most too tearing on the mind," he lamented. It's sometimes hard to separate Twain's real complaints from his curmudgeonly persona, so maybe he was exaggerating. But by 1875, he had given away his typewriter and decided to endorse new fountain pens for two companies. His adoration of expensive pens never flagged, even when it took a royal amount of cussing to make the things go. Parker 51s, they were not. Still, Twain did more than anyone to ensure the eventual triumph of typewriters over high-end pens. He submitted the first typewritten manuscript to a publisher, Life on the Mississippi, in 1883. It was dictated to a secretary, not typed by Twain. And when the Remington Typewriter Company asked him to endorse its machines, Twain had reluctantly bought another. He declined with a crusty letter, which Remington turned around and printed anyway. Even the acknowledgement that Twain, probably the most popular person in America, owned one, was endorsement enough. Author's note. The text of the letter Twain sent to Remington, which the company printed verbatim, is as follows. "Gentlemen, please do not use my name in any way. Please do not even divulge the fact that I own a machine. I have entirely stopped using the typewriter for the reason that I never could write a letter with it to anybody without receiving a request by return mail that I would not only describe the machine, but state what progress I had made in the use of it, etc., etc. I don't like to write letters, and so I don't want people to know I own this curiosity-breeding little joker. Yours truly, Samuel L. Clemens. These stories of cussing out pens he loved and using typewriters he hated underline a contradiction in Twain. Though perhaps the antithesis of Goethe in a literary sense, the demotic, democratic Twain shared Goethe's ambivalence about technology. Twain had no pretensions of practicing science, but both he and Goethe were fascinated by scientific discovery. At the same time, they doubted Homo sapiens had enough wisdom to use the technology properly. In Goethe, this doubt manifested itself as Faust, and Twain wrote what we might recognize today as science fiction. Really. In contrast to his laddish riverboat novels, he wrote short stories about inventions, technology, dystopias, space, and time travel. Even in his bemusing story, Sold to Satan, The Perils of the Periodic Table. The story, 2,000 words long, starts shortly after a hypothetical crash of steel shares around 1904. The narrator, sick of scrabbling for money, decides to sell his immortal soul to Mephistopheles. To hammer out a deal, he and Satan meet in a dark, unnamed lair at midnight, drink some hot toddies, and discuss the depressingly modest going price for souls. Pretty soon, though, they're sidetracked by an unusual feature of Satan's anatomy. He's made entirely of radium. 6 years before Twain's story, Marie Curie had astounded the scientific world with her tales of radioactive elements. It was genuine news, but Twain must have been pretty plugged into the scientific scene to incorporate all the cheeky details he did into Sold to Satan. Radium's radioactivity charges the air around it electrically, so Satan glows a luminescent green to the narrator's delight. Also, like a warm-blooded rock, radium is always hotter than its surroundings, because its radioactivity heats it up. This heat grows exponentially as more radium is concentrated together. As a result, Twain's 6'1", 900-odd-pound Satan is hot enough to light a cigar with his fingertip. He quickly puts it out, though, to save it for Voltaire. Hearing this, the narrator makes Satan take 50 more cigars for, among others, Goethe. Later, the story goes into some detail about refining radioactive metals. It's far from Twain's sharpest material, but like the best science fiction, it's prescient. To avoid incinerating people he comes across, radium-bodied Satan wears a protective coat of polonium, another new element discovered by Curie. Scientifically, this is rubbish, a transparent shell of polonium, thin as a gelatin film, could never withhold the heat of a critical mass of radium. But we'll forgive Twain, since the polonium serves a larger dramatic purpose. It gives Satan a reason to threaten, "If I should strip off my skin, the world would vanish away in a flash of flame and a puff of smoke, and the remnants of the extinguished moon would sift down through space, a mere snow shower of gray ashes." Twain being Twain, he could not let the devil end the story in a position of power. The trapped radium heat is so intense that Satan soon admits, with unintended irony, "I burn. I suffer within." But jokes aside, Twain was already trembling about the awesome power of nuclear energy in 1904. Had he lived 40 years more, he surely would have shaken his head, dispirited yet hardly surprised, to see people lusting after nuclear missiles instead of plentiful atomic energy. Unlike Goethe's forays into hard science, Twain's stories about science can still be read today with instruction. Twain surveyed the lower realm of the periodic table with despair. But of all the tales of artists and elements, none seems sadder or harsher or more Faustian than poet Robert Lowell's adventures with one of the primordial elements, lithium, at the very top of the table. When they were all youngsters at a prep school in the early 1930s, friends nicknamed Lowell Cal, after Caliban, the howling man-beast in the tempest. Others swear Caligula inspired the epithet. Either way, the name fit the confessional poet, who exemplified the mad artist, someone like Van Gogh or Poe, whose genius stems from parts of the psyche most of us cannot access, much less harness for artistic purposes. Unfortunately, Lowell couldn't rein in his madness outside the margins of his poems, and his lunacy bled all over his real life. He once turned up sputtering on a friend's doorstep, convinced that he, Lowell, was the Virgin Mary. Another time, in Bloomington, Indiana, he convinced himself he could stop cars on the highway by spreading his arms wide like Jesus. In classes he taught, he wasted hours babbling and rewriting the poems of nonplussed students in the obsolete style of Tennyson or Milton. When 19, he abandoned a fiancée and drove from Boston to the country house of a Tennessee poet who Lowell hoped would mentor him. He just assumed that the man would put him up. The poet graciously explained there was no room at the inn, so to speak, and joked that Lowell would have to camp on the lawn if he wanted to stay. Lowell nodded and left. For Sears. He bought a pup tent and returned to rough it on the grass. The literary public delighted in these stories, and during the 1950s and 1960s, Lowell was the preeminent poet in the United States, winning prizes and selling thousands of books. Everyone assumed Lowell's aberrations were the touch of some madly divine muse. Pharmaceutical psychology, a field coming into its own in that era, had a different explanation. Cal had a chemical imbalance, which rendered him manic-depressive. The public saw only the wild man, not his incapacitating black moods, moods that left him broken spiritually and increasingly broke financially. Luckily, the first real mood stabilizer, lithium, came to the United States in 1967. A desperate Lowell, who'd just been incarcerated in a psychiatric ward where doctors had confiscated his belt and shoelaces, agreed to be medicated. Curiously, for all its potency as a drug, lithium has no normal biological role. It's not an essential mineral like iron or magnesium, or even a trace nutrient like chromium. In fact, pure lithium is a scarily reactive metal. People's linty pockets have reportedly caught fire when keys or coins short-circuited portable lithium batteries as they jangled down the street. Nor does lithium, which in its drug form is a salt, lithium carbonate, work the way we expect drugs to. We take antibiotics at the height of an infection to knock the microbes out. But taking lithium at the height of mania or in the canyon of depression won't fix the episode. Lithium only prevents the next episode from starting. And although scientists knew about lithium's efficacy back in 1886, until recently they had no clue why it worked. Lithium tweaks many mood-altering chemicals in the brain, and its effects are complicated. Most interesting, lithium seems to reset the body's circadian rhythm, its inner clock. In normal people, ambient conditions, especially the sun, dictate their humors and determine whether they are tuckered out for the day. They're on a 24-hour cycle. Bipolar people run on cycles independent of the sun, and run and run. When they're feeling good, their brains flood them with sunshiny neurostimulants, and a lack of sunshine does not turn the spigot off. Some call it pathological enthusiasm. Such people barely need sleep, and their self-confidence swells to the point that a Bostonian male in the 20th century can believe that the Holy Spirit has chosen him as the vessel of Jesus Christ. Eventually, those surges deplete the brain, and people crash. Severe manic depressives, when the black dogs have them, sometimes take to bed for weeks. Lithium regulates the proteins that control the body's inner clock. This clock runs, oddly, on DNA, inside special neurons deep in the brain. Special proteins attach to people's DNA each morning, and after a fixed time, they degrade and fall off. Sunlight resets the proteins over and over, so they hold on much longer. In fact, the proteins fall off only after darkness falls, at which point the brain should notice the bare DNA and stop producing stimulants. This process goes awry in manic depressives because the proteins, despite the lack of sunlight, remain bound fast to their DNA. Their brains don't realize they should stop revving. Lithium helps cleave the proteins from DNA so people can wind down. Notice that sunlight still trumps lithium during the day and resets the proteins. It's only when the sunlight goes away at night that lithium helps DNA shake free. Far from being sunshine in a pill, then, lithium acts as anti-sunlight. Neurologically, it undoes sunlight and thereby compresses the circadian clock back to 24 hours, preventing both the mania bubble from forming and the Black Tuesday crash into depression. Lowell responded immediately to lithium. His personal life grew steadier, though by no means steady, and at one point he pronounced himself cured. From his new, stable perspective, he could see how his old life, full of fights, drinking binges, and divorces, had laid waste to so many people. For all his frank and moving lines within his poems, nothing Lowell ever wrote was as poignant, and nothing about the fragile chemistry of human beings was as moving, as a simple plaint to his publisher, Robert Giroux, after doctors started him on lithium. "It's terrible, Bob," he said, "to think that all I've suffered and all the suffering I've caused might have arisen from the lack of a little salt in my brain." Lowell felt that his life improved on lithium, yet the effect of lithium on his art was debatable. As Lowell did, most artists feel that trading a manic depressive cycle for a muted, prosaic circadian rhythm allows them to work productively without being distracted by mania or sedated by depression. There's always been debate, though, about whether their work suffers after their cure, after they've lost access to that part of the psyche most of us never glimpse. Many artists report feeling flatlined or tranquilized on lithium. One of Lowell's friends reported that he looked like something transported around in a zoo. And his poetry undoubtedly changed after 1967, growing rougher and purposely less polished. He also, instead of inventing lines from his wild mind, began poaching lines from private letters, which outraged the people he quoted. Such work won Lowell a Pulitzer Prize in 1974, but it hasn't weathered well. Especially compared with his vivacious younger work, it's barely read today. For all that the periodic table inspired Goethe, Twain, and others, Lowell's lithium may be a case where it provided health, but subdued art, and made a mad genius merely human.